is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, can the Ebola virus infect the United States? Plus, why Europe has better sunscreen protection than the U.S. and why the FDA needs to change. But first, are routine pelvic exams really necessary? Well, the annual pelvic exam has long been a routine part of women's health care, but now new guidelines say it's not necessary. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Renee Mested. She is the assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Mested. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So the American College of Physicians, which I understand is the nation's second largest physicians organization, has just come out with some new guidelines that say that healthy women do not need routine pelvic exams, and then in fact they can do more harm than good. Can you help us understand that?
So what the American College of Physicians did was they reviewed studies for the past, back down to I think 1950s, that evaluated the various aspects of the pelvic exam, both looking at how well it detects ovarian cancers as well as infections like bacterial vaginosis, which is a fairly common female infection. They found through those studies that the pelvic exam, the routine pelvic exam, wasn't very good for detecting either ovarian cancer or bacterial vaginosis.
Can you say that more slowly?
Bacterial vaginosis.
Oh, bacterial vaginosis.
Better known as BV.
Okay.
And additionally, some of the studies also looked at how women perceived the pelvic exam. Some women dread it. Some women are very anxious about going to the doctor because they know they're going to have to have this exam. Some women actually delay even seeing an obstetrician or gynecologist because they are concerned that they might have to have a pelvic exam, and they've heard horror stories from girlfriends and sisters about the pelvic exam.
So the exam itself might be a deterrent in their mind to actually getting good medical care.
Yes.
Okay.
So as a result of the evaluation of the data indicating that women are potentially deterred from seeing their physician due to a pelvic exam, and that the pelvic exam does not seem to find things like ovarian cancer or bacterial vaginosis, they've determined that it has the potential for doing more harm than good, and that it should no longer be a part of the routine annual health care.
But if there was no good evidence that they found, why did these become such a routine part of women's health care? I mean, what was the thinking behind it at the outset? This routine, this idea of all women, whatever age, once they become sexually active,
right,
are necessary to have a routine pelvic exam.
Well, so what it gets back in the beginning, which I wasn't there for,
right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
A long time ago, cervical cancer was the number one killer of women, cancer killer of women. And we did not have, the only way we could ever even consider detecting cervical cancer was through a pelvic exam way back, before pap smears were available.
So it basically became part then,
yes,
of what was kind of the armamentour of,
right,
what doctors could do at the time, but it continued to be carried along.
Exactly. And the thing is that most women don't actually examine their genitalia. They don't look at their labia, they don't look at the vulva, and they're unable to look inside their vagina because most women aren't that agile.
Mm-hmm.
Basically.
Mm-hmm.
So it continued because it was the only way that anyone would ever actually do that exam. Women can examine their own breasts. Women can examine their skin for melanomas and other cancers, or they can have their partner or a family member or a friend do those exams, but there is nobody else to examine the vulva, vagina,
mm-hmm,
or cervix.
So it seems like it would have made sense that this would become routine, but now after they reviewed, I saw something like 52 different articles showing that there really wasn't, that this was not a really accurate way to just, as you said, discover the infection, this common infection,
right,
or cervical cancer for that matter.
Well, it's ovarian cancer.
Ovarian cancer, yes. That's correct. So, but I think one of the things that is important in this whole recommendation is that they make a very clear distinction that they still need to go for cervical cancer checks and the pap smear.
Yes.
How is that accomplished without a pelvic exam?
So, the two portions of the pelvic exam are visual inspection. So the healthcare provider will inspect the external genitalia, the labia, the vulva, and then place a speculum inside the vagina to look at the vaginal walls and then look at the cervix. So that's one part of the pelvic exam is the visual inspection. At that time with the speculum, the pap smear is done. And with a pap smear, the provider takes a sample of the cells from the cervix, which is then looked at with the microscope by a cytopathologist. And additionally, nowadays, we're able to get a sample we're able to detect if there's human papillomavirus, the HPV, which is the virus that causes the majority of cervical cancers. The other portion of the pelvic exam is the bimanual or internal exam, where the provider places one or two fingers into the vagina and the other hand on the abdomen, and is able to feel the internal organs, the uterus and the ovaries.
So it is that part that they're saying is not helpful.
Yes.
Not the first part, not the visual inspection, which they still are advocating.
Although they're only advocating it at the time of the pap smear, which for women who don't have any signs of the HPV infection or have always had normal pap smears, only needs to be done every 3 to 5 years, depending on her age.
So that has changed as well.
Yes.
Because at one time, wasn't the pap smear part of the routine exam, which
yes.
was taking place on an annual basis?
Exactly.
So there's really been a cutback then in the frequency with which women would have to have these kinds of evaluations.
Yes.
And there's good data, I'm gathering, to support that notion.
There's very good data supporting the change in guidelines for the frequency of pap smears. Unfortunately, the data that the ACP, the American College of Physicians, is using to determine that routine pelvic exams are no longer necessary is not great, which they stated in their article itself is it was moderate at best, the studies that they had. But again, they only encompassed ovarian cancer, bacterial vaginosis. They stated that there wasn't any good or bad data. There wasn't enough data to determine pelvic inflammatory disease, which can lead to infertility for young women. They didn't even discuss vulvar cancer, vaginal cancer, other infections. They didn't discuss incontinence. They didn't discuss sexual dysfunction.
So there are a lot of issues surrounding that. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with obstetrician-gynecologist Dr. Renee Mested, and we're talking about the new guideline about routine pelvic exams. So I want to get this clear at this point. Exactly what is their recommendation, and how do you feel that falls short of the mark? Because that's what I'm picking up here.
So the American College of Physicians recommends against a routine screening pelvic
for
exam. For healthy women.
Let me just interrupt you there. So when should it be done? What types of women do need it routinely or annually?
So women, or I guess we should say asymptomatic women, women who don't have any complaints of anything pertaining to their vagina or pelvic organs. So women who are complaining of pain, who are noticing pain with sex, who are noticing that their periods have become heavy.
Abnormal bleeding, some kind of that.
Exactly. Pain with their periods, leaking urine, weird discharges, vaginal itching, burning with urination, because often what's considered to be a bladder infection is actually a vaginal infection that causes that kind of pain. Those women definitely need a pelvic examination.
And how often would that be necessary? Or is that, in other words, if you're having those kinds of problems, would you still go back to this idea of a routine annual exam?
That's kind of hard.
On a case-by-case basis,
right.
I would think,
so,
as well.
So a lot of women will only see their gynecologist once a year. And often what happens is she detects an abnormal discharge or her periods start to become painful. And so she calls and says, I need my annual exam. And once she gets into the office with a physician, then she discusses the actual concerns that she has. But most women will call the receptionist and not want to discuss the various problems. So And quite honestly, most women don't come to see us all that often unless they have an acute problem like a discharge or a recently painful or heavy period. So the idea that they need to come every year, for some women, that's they will make up a list of their problems and reserve them for that one visit each year. So in some cases, it's almost not a deterrent for some women to have a pelvic exam because they know, I'm going to have a pelvic exam, so we will address those problems at that time, and I won't go see her provider earlier at a different time.
So I guess what I'm hearing from you is that there's not a universal agreement at this point with what the American College of Physicians came out with. It sounds like, for example, I read somewhere that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists still consider it an important
yes.
element of their treatment plan or their evaluative plan.
Yes, they do. Because these studies, like I said, the studies that the American College of Physicians is basing their recommendation on is not extensive. It's a lot of studies, but it doesn't cover the full gamut of
potential problems.
Exactly. And I've had, and this is now anecdotal, we prefer not to practice medicine anecdotally, but given that we don't have a lot of very good hard evidence, this is what we have to work with. I've had many patients who I have asked them if they're having problems with leaking urine, and they've told me no, and I do her exam, and the skin is very disrupted because she's been leaking urine. I have patients who have severe vaginal atrophy, and it turns out they haven't had sex with their husbands for 10 years because it hurts so much. And the assumption is, well, that's just part of aging. I've had patients who ultimately have endometriosis, and they've had painful periods for 4 or 5 years as young women, and have just assumed that's just what it's about. The periods are supposed to be that way. My mother had painful periods. My sister did. And so in their minds, they are asymptomatic and normal, but in
reality,
they
don't really know what normal is.
Exactly. Their quality of life is not as good as it could be, and I and my colleagues have been able to find this because we did do a pelvic exam. So
in your mind, what are you basically, I mean, it sounds to me like you have a very different, you have a different
right.
perspective on this as a practicing obstetrician
right.
gynecologist. And so what are you telling your patients?
I still strongly recommend the annual pelvic exam, both the visual and the bimanual exam. There are some patients who, for whom it really isn't necessary, much older women, young women who want to start oral contraceptives. The pelvic exam is not necessary for them. And I hope that most physicians will stop doing that because I don't want to deter a 15-year-old coming in for her birth control pills because she's afraid of getting a pelvic exam.
So that's a good point. So what you're saying is it's almost like not one size fits all.
Exactly.
Decisions have to be made on a case-by-case basis. And
exactly.
Really the relationship between the physician and the patient is really the crucial determinant. I mean, all those different factors, their history, their life history, their family social history, and what their particular issues are to be taken into.
And that's what I think medicine is working towards now, is actually having a conversation between the patient and the physician, and the two of them making the decision together.
Well, I think that's very, very good advice, and it's interesting to understand that there's more to the story than something like a major guideline. I mean, it sounds to me like some of this could have been cost-driven, because I read somewhere that the annual cost of preventive screenings, lab tests, and radiologic services, they were estimating at $2.6 billion, and you'd hate to have the money basically be driving healthcare like that.
So. Yes.
I want to thank you once again for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Renee Mested. She's assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Upstate Medical University with very good information and advice. Thanks again. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Up next, can the Ebola virus infect the United States? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, Dr. Kent Brandley and Nancy Reitbold, the two American aid workers who contracted Ebola in Liberia during one of the worst outbreaks that the continent has seen, returned to the United States for treatment in Atlanta Hospital, prompting many to fear that this could bring the deadly virus to our shores. Well, here with more on this is Dr. Timothy Endy. He's the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Endy. Thank you very much for having me. So these two patients were brought to the United States, and a lot of precautions were taken to try to keep them isolated. Why are these precautions so crucial in terms of Ebola?
Well, in part, the outbreak that's occurring in the three countries in Africa right now, and it's been known historically that Ebola is contagious, and it's spread by human-to-human contact, especially from infected body fluids. Which could be, for example, vomit or bleeding. And so that the precautions are needed to prevent the spread to the healthcare providers who are taking care of them.
Let's start with, I think a lot of people are kind of bandying the term about Ebola, but what exactly is Ebola?
Well, Ebola is a virus and is in a family of viruses called the filoviruses. Their genetic code is consisting of RNA or ribonucleic acid. And so it's an RNA virus, and it has a very distinctive morphology. It's a long, thin virus with a characteristic curve at the end of it called a shepherd's crook. So that when you see it under a high-powered microscope, like an electron microscope, the features are very distinctive for the filoviruses. There are several, I think there are five or six strains of Ebola virus, named from the countries where they're isolated, like Zaire. And then there's a close cousin of Ebola called Marburg, which also produces a very similar set of symptoms and hemorrhagic disease, as well as very responsible for some very well-known large outbreaks in Africa.
Do we know where it came from?
No one's quite sure, and there's been a lot of investigations. There's one particular cave in Zaire that was investigated from an outbreak where they've never really found a source, though it's been isolated from a particular bat called a fruit bat from Africa, and they think that that might be the reservoir for this virus.
So it had jumped from animal to human, which not all viruses do, and now basically once it's jumped to humans, human-to-human contact is the way it's being spread.
Correct.
So why is it so deadly? I read somewhere it kills 50 to 90% of its victims.
Well, it's a very what we call pathogenic virus. And what's characteristic of a lot of viruses that do what you described as jump from one species to another, the virus, its whole goal is actually to adapt to that particular host. So killing the host doesn't really do the virus very much service in its ability to transmit and propagate. So in a reservoir host, like in a fruit bat, for example, they don't become sick or die from the virus. The virus actually is replicating.
They're just a carrier.
But when they jump to another species, they're not well adapted, and they produce a lot of tissue and organ damage, and that results in the severity of the symptoms and also the high mortality. Rabies virus is a great example of that. There's a reservoir in bats, for example, but when it goes into humans from the bite or saliva of that reservoir host, then the mortality is like near 100%.
Wow. So what causes death? What actually leads to someone to die from Ebola?
Well, there's such tremendous cell and tissue damage that there's organ failure. So kidney failure, liver failure, because of all the tissue destruction that goes on. And so death is by those organs not being able to function very well. Plus, it causes a hemorrhagic disease, so you're not able to clot your blood as well, and you bleed out into the gastrointestinal tract and can die from bleeding.
So right now, do they really understand how it's transmitted? I've read many, many things in the news they're talking about. It's transmitted, you know, basically bodily fluids and direct contact. But these two workers, for example, that were in Africa, were covered and were wearing hazmat suits, I would think, and taking precautions. Do we really understand fully how this disease is transmitted?
Well, I think there's still a lot of questions that we don't understand about transmission. We do know that body fluids are infected and can be transmitted to humans through splashing the eye, the mucous membranes, through needle sticks and such. In these two particular patients, it's not really clear. I'm not familiar with what the circumstances were, how they got infected. But I think, you know, you have to understand the conditions that they're working on in these countries. It's very primitive. Even though they are wearing containment type clothing, it's probably 110 degrees there. They're sweating profusely. There's no air conditioning. They're overtired. There's fatigue. There's a lot of chaos going on. You can probably imagine some breaks in procedures that results in infection.
So that it's not clear whether it was a breakdown. It's more likely that there was a breakdown in procedure or in prevention that caused them to become infected, is what you're postulating, rather than some unknown source or reason for transmission.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would, you know, guess. I can imagine they're probably working 14, 15-hour days, and your concentration level and your procedures can take a hit at the end of a long day.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on air. I'm Linda Cohen here with infectious disease expert Dr. Timothy Endy, and we're talking about Ebola. Well, you've had a very special history with Ebola. Tell us about that.
Well, I had the privilege of being the head of virology at the United States Army Medical Research Institute for Infectious Disease, which is located at Fort Detrick in the early 2000s. Fort Detrick is it's a high-level containment laboratory. It's called the BO4 lab. Richard Preston wrote a book about it called The Hot Zone.
Oh, yeah.
And it's where you wear the blue suits and the air cables and all that. And my division was in charge of developing vaccines and therapeutics and understanding the pathogenesis of Ebola, Marburg, and some other nasty viruses, once called Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. So I had the opportunity to be in the lab and, you know, work on projects with Ebola.
Was any progress made during the time you were there in terms of either talking about developing a vaccine or treatment protocols?
There's a lot of progress. There is a number of candidate vaccines that showed very good promise in non-human primate studies.
But not yet. And that was the other point that I wanted to bring out, is that these two individuals who were brought here were given some kind of a treatment that was more of a experimental treatment, this ZMAT product that I guess is in development. And does that suggest that we're closer to more effective treatment for something like Ebola, or even to develop prevention like a vaccine?
Well, I think there are a number of different candidate vaccines that have shown some preliminary promise in animal studies for protection. I'm not familiar with the ZMAP product in itself, though I know it's a monoclonal antibody that's very specific for the Ebola virus. And antibodies have been used historically. For example, the Russians have been using hyperimmune globulin, which is a concentrated immune globulin for the treatment and protection of Ebola. But the data from that is kind of iffy in terms of how protective it is.
So we're not quite there yet. And we don't even know if this ZMAT really has had an influence or whether the people are just recovering on their own with...
That's right. You know, it hasn't been done in a controlled fashion. It's the subject size is two people. But certainly from what you hear on the news, it sounds very promising.
So in this era of global travel and era of global diseases, therefore... I mean, anything is a plane ride away from coming to our shores. At one point, I talked to you many years ago about dengue, and at that time, dengue had just started showing itself on the continental United States, and it had been other places, third world countries before that. So we are all really an international or global community these days. What should we be doing, or could we be doing, and why is it the case that we don't need to fear, perhaps, the spread of these diseases here in the United States? What's in place here?
Well, it's all about infrastructure, and certainly the Ebola outbreaks that are occurring in the African countries, in large part part is blamed on the lack of infrastructure there. So, you know, we in the United States are privileged to have a very well organized and functional public health system. We have just outstanding standards of health care delivery. And
we know also how to isolate and quarantine and prevent the spread of these kinds of diseases once they're identified.
That's true. But not to to be overly optimistic, you know, we are still vulnerable. And I can tell you numbers of examples. West Nile is a great one, right? Where it was introduced in New York City and within a matter of 5 years spread through the entire continental United States, producing thousands of deaths. Mm. So West Nile is an example of how vulnerable we are to these pathogens that can arrive from a traveler that goes from Africa to Syracuse, New York, in about 30 hours by airplane. And it's happened, and it's happened before. You know, we here at Upstate, we treat 12 to 15 cases of severe malaria a year, and these are from all travelers who come out of endemic countries with malaria.
So what would happen, or what does happen, when someone comes to the ED with these kinds of symptoms where you worry about either malaria or something like Ebola? What actually takes place?
Well, first is recognition, you know, asking the right questions and then recognizing what potentially could be some serious infection that's causing the patient's problem. The second is if it's contagious. Certainly the ED is well set up in Upstate, has the facilities for the proper isolation of patients, and then the infection control practices to protect the healthcare providers from becoming infected in the process.
And in the past, in these circumstances that you've alluded to, you were able to contain the problem.
Sure. Yeah. You know, we have naturally contagious infections as well in Onondaga County, tuberculosis being one of them. And we get TB patients all the time. And there are isolation procedures and special masks that we wear to protect ourselves.
I mean, there's been talk about SARS, avian flu, many of these types of things mm-hmm. have been threats. And yet, what you're seems to be underscoring is that with the right public health measures and the right infection control within institutions and within the public at large, much of that can be forestalled.
Absolutely. But the very first critical step is recognition. And that can be a very important critical step.
And it sounds like right now in this country they are testing people before they get on planes from those three countries, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. And they're also being tested when they get here. So we are taking those precautions in terms of who's showing up with potential symptoms.
Yes.
And as we said, you're only spreading the disease when you're symptomatic?
There is a symptomatic period with fever, but you're probably spreading the disease several days before the onset of the severe symptoms because the virus is actually in your blood. So probably just before the symptoms and then for probably several weeks after the symptoms have gone away, you might be still infected, you know, being able to transmit the infection.
Well, I appreciate all this, you know, insight and hopefulness that we are in good shape in this country and clearly here in this region. And I want to thank you so much for coming in and hopefully allaying some of our fears. My guest has been Dr. Timothy Endy, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. In our expert advice from the experts at Upstate today, we have orthopedic surgeon Dr. William Lavelle explaining what to do for a knot in your shoulder.
So this is what we do when we have patients who have a knot in their shoulder, as my parents would call it, or a muscle pull or muscle sprain. Typically, these happen very acutely. They can cause pretty traumatic pain in an isolated spot of your shoulder. And the best thing to do, be it as a cause from a problem with your neck or a problem with your shoulder, is first to stop the activity that has caused it. If that doesn't settle the symptoms down, the best thing to do, as a muscle is a unit that contracts and goes into spasm, is first to try to stretch that muscle as best as you can. So if that muscle is in fact a muscle on the back of your shoulder, the best thing to do is to try to stretch that muscle. typically I recommend patients to try to bring their arm across the chest and to try to stretch the muscle out in that way. If that doesn't help, the next best thing is to have someone to try to manually stretch the muscle out itself. There can be common areas that this happens to people over and over again, and in medicine we call those trigger points because they trigger the muscle to go into spasm and to cause the patient's pain. If this happens over and over again, one of the things that we can do is actually a local injection into the area to try to break up the trigger point. There are oral medicines that can help too for symptoms that happen over and over again. But most of the time, patients simply just require to avoid the activity that causes them that kind of pain. And if it happens, again, the best thing to do is to try to immediately stretch the muscle to prevent it from going into what's called tetany or spasm.
Coming up next, why does Europe have better sunscreen products than we do? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of August 11th. Serve a sensational salad. Salad often gets a bad reputation as a diet food, but it can be a delicious, colorful way to get more veggies. To turn your salad into a well-rounded meal, start with dark, leafy greens and add fresh vegetables, fruits, beans, nuts, seeds, and perhaps even some protein like tofu, fish, or meat. You can mix in some creative, healthy dressing like hummus, guacamole, or a fruit-infused vinaigrette. Experiment with your own salad creations this week. Write down your favorite combination so you can enjoy it again. Have a healthy Monday and a very healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, current estimates are that 1 in 5 Americans will develop skin cancer in their lifetime, with more than 3.5 million non-melanoma skin cancers diagnosed in the United States annually. Melanoma, the most serious form of skin cancer, has been increasing for at least the last 30 years, and it's estimated that there will be almost 140,000 new cases this year alone. That has led public health advocates to cheer on a recent congressional effort to speed up the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA's, approval process of new sunscreen ingredients that they say could prevent skin cancer and save lives. Well, here on with more on this is Dr. Ramsey Farah. He's an associate professor of medicine and pathology and the division chief of dermatology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. So by 2015, I read somewhere that it's estimated that 1 in 50 Americans will develop melanoma in their lifetime. This is a pretty serious problem. Why this increase? Do we really understand why?
So I would agree that it's definitely a serious health problem. And if you take a look at the rates of increase of melanoma and other skin cancers, it's really, you can define it almost as an epidemic. In fact, skin cancer generally is the most common human cancer. So there's no other cancer that's more prevalent than some form of skin cancer. So it is really a big deal. So why is this happening? Of course, it's difficult to pinpoint one particular factor, but I think there are many factors and elements that go into the mix. The first thing is, people are living longer, and so they have a chance, more of a chance to develop skin cancer. So I think that's definitely operating. But nonetheless, I should qualify that we're seeing melanomas in younger and younger individuals. So it's not just that people are living longer, although that's part of it. The second thing is I think that there is a social outlook and expectation that the sun is healthy and having a tan is healthy. And to a certain extent, that's true. I mean, the sun is healthy in moderation. You need your vitamin D levels and so forth.
But especially in a climate like ours where we have so little sun, for many months of the year. I know when it comes to things like osteoporosis and getting vitamin D, that's the only source.
Sure, and that's very important. And, you know, oftentimes dermatologists are unfairly labeled as these fanatics about sunscreen with no regard to vitamin D, and that's not true. We acknowledge that vitamin D levels are important, and sun exposure in the proper way is important, but people take it beyond that, and having a deep, rich tan is taken as a social sign of affluence and leisure and beauty, and that's desirable, so people seek that look. And then the other thing to consider is the sun that we have today is different than the sun of 50 or 100 years ago. There's a lot more pollution in the air. There's a lot more scatter of the UV radiation from the sun. And I think all of those mix in together to give rise to the statistics that we see.
And there's been all this talk about the depletion of the ozone layer, and as a result, the intensity of the rays that we were receiving are less filtered or less protective.
Sure, absolutely. I don't know whether this is still true, but in the recent past, the highest rates of melanoma were found in Queensland, Australia. And the reason for that is Queensland, Australia had one of the bigger ozone holes over it. And the individuals living there, many of them at least, were of Northern European descent. So you have the mix of no ozone layer, intense sunlight, and fair-skinned individuals, and that gave us the highest melanoma rates in the world. And I would just add as an aside, the Australians took that very seriously, and they instituted a very rigorous program for sunscreen protection and sun protection with kids starting at the elementary school level, and they were able to track that they decreased their rates of skin cancer. So these things do work.
So prevention does work, and
yes,
that's what I wanted to get to. So what are the current recommendations with regard to prevention right now, and are they different for skin cancer in general and melanoma in particular, or is it just a kind of a uniform approach?
It's fairly uniform. Because all three of the major skin cancers, basal cells, squamous cells, and melanoma, are very closely related to the amount of sun exposure and UV radiation and DNA damage in your skin. So the recommendations are try to go outside before 10 o'clock and after 2, because between 10 and 2, the sun is at its highest zenith, and so you get less filtration of the atmosphere of the rays. Number two, put your sunscreen on a half hour before you go out in the sun. Try and wear hats and protective clothing to the extent that it's possible. And these days there are tons and tons of options in terms of clothes that have an ultraviolet filtration.
Does regular clothing by itself also protect? In other words, I understand that there are clothes being marketed now that have what they call UV protection, but
right,
if you were to just perhaps wear a cotton long sleeve shirt, for example, do you get the same degree of protection?
Not the same degree. The degree of protection is entirely related to the density of the weave. And so the trick is to get dense weaves with clothes that are light and airy, comfortable and fashionable. And so a cotton shirt will help a little bit, but not enough. So, you know, putting the sunscreens on, wearing protective hats and clothing. And in terms of prevention, really getting a yearly skin exam with your local friendly dermatologist, or at least your primary care as a start. If they see something, they can refer you on to derm.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with dermatologist Dr. Ramzi Farah. We're talking about skin cancer and also this new bill that's been set to speed up the FDA's approval of new sunscreen protection products. Let's talk about this bill and why it's important. I understand it's called the Sunscreen Innovation Act. It's a bipartisan bill that was introduced recently in both the House and Senate, and it's trying to fast-track some of these sunscreens. What has been the problem? I mean, it's my understanding that Europe now has far superior sunscreen products than the U.S. Tell us about that.
So I'm glad that this bill is being pushed through. It's hard to believe that there's anything bipartisan these days.
Exactly,
but at least,
right.
At least the skin can bring people together.
Right.
So I think the main issue is, as you perhaps have alluded to, that in Europe, sunscreen products are considered cosmetic, whereas in America, they're considered medications. And so the approval process in America has been very slow and cumbersome. And while that could be a benefit in terms of not putting things out that are dangerous, that can also be cumbersome and hinder things that would benefit the public. So I think the last FDA-approved product or ingredient for sunscreens has been about 10 or 15 years ago. And the issue becomes we're limited in our choice of sunscreens and sunscreen materials. And that decreases the quality of the sunscreens, and it probably decreases the compliance that in which people use them. Because if there's a sunscreen you don't like, you really don't have a choice to go to the supermarket and try something else, whereas in Europe they do.
Yes, yeah, so why are they different in Europe, or what about them is different? What elements or ingredients?
So the sunscreens work because they have certain ingredients in them that actually absorb the ultraviolet radiation and to some degree dissipate it so it doesn't go into your skin and
damage
your cells.
So is it both UVA and UVB?
That's
right. Those are the two types of ultraviolet rays.
Both. And the U.S. sunscreens are not very good at getting UVA radiation. And so having other, we'll call them chemicals or substances,
right,
that do a better job at that will enhance the efficiency and the effectiveness of the sunscreen.
So I understand this new bill is basically saying now that new sunscreen applications they're trying to push within 11 months and existing applications that have already been sitting there for a while within 8 months to fast track them. I guess currently it's been a very, very prolonged process for the reasons that you indicated. I mean, some of it just may be bureaucracy, but
right,
that whole notion that it's being treated as a drug, so perhaps a lot of drug trials or tests or whatever. And it seems like at this point the United States public is really being disaffected. I mean, they don't have the opportunity to benefit from these new products that are safe.
Right. I think they are safe, certainly, because now we have a track record in Europe. So it's not as if we're coming out with things that have never been tried and true. There's a long track record in Europe, and so there's really no reason to wait any longer. We have, in a sense, the public safety data.
I read somewhere, I think recently, that there was some very, very shocking statistic that there's been a 200% increase in melanoma in this year, which is, somewhat shocking. Is it true in Europe as well? Do you know if there's a comparison between American stats with melanoma versus European?
Sure. They are comparable, yeah. Yes, they are. And it's the issues that we all talked about, the public perception, people living longer, and the environmental factors. So all around, it's increasing. But of course, the darker the skin you have, the more natural protection you have. So the rates of skin cancers generally and melanoma in darker individuals do not parallel those of white-skinned, light-haired, and blue-eyed individuals of Northern Europe.
So that obviously fair-skinned people are more prone
definitely
to it. Yeah, that's something that I don't think people always understand. Can people with dark skin also, though, get melanoma?
Yes, they can, for sure. So we the measures we're talking about apply really to all individuals, but they're definitely more critical for light-skinned individuals.
So help us understand what your current recommendations are with regard to protection. You mentioned overview, some of those things, but I'm sure you have patients, for example, who may go to a tanning booth. I mean, things like that. Give us your overview in the little bit of time we have left.
Sure. So, oftentimes when you see patients in the clinic, each patient is different. So their risk factors and their background are a little bit different. So one size doesn't always fit everyone. So, for example, someone who has a family history of melanoma, they're very light-skinned, they've gone to tanning salons, they've had more than 3 sunburns. I mean, I see those individuals every 4 to 6 months or so, and I keep finding things. So someone else without that history, it may suffice to just have a yearly skin exam. But I just wanted to comment on the tanning booth industry. It's been shown that if you just go 10 times or more to a tanning booth, just 10 times, you double your risk for a skin cancer.
Wow.
So I really stress that that kind of behavior should be stopped. It's really healthier to get natural sunlight than to go to the tanning salons if you must do something. But both should be viewed with caution. And really, the tanning booths are like the smoking issue was to the lungs. The tanning booths are to the skin. I think that's the best analogy.
Very briefly, what SPF is appropriate, sure, and how often do you apply? We really have only a little bit,
right,
of time.
So SPF of 30 or above, but 30 is fine. You don't need SPF 200 as long as you apply it every 2 to 3 hours when you're out in direct sun.
And how about children? Should you be putting it on more frequently?
SPFs? Same amounts in children, but sun damage in kids is more detrimental. That's been clearly shown with all of the science. So the trick with kids is to get them into those habits early on so that they carry them through.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Ramsey Farr. He's an associate professor of medicine and pathology and the division chief of dermatology at Upstate Medical University. Wonderful information. Once again, thanks.
Thanks. A pleasure.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. So much of illness involves waiting. We wait for appointments. We wait for diagnoses. We wait for treatments. We wait for outcomes. We hurry from one appointment to another, but mostly we wait. Elizabeth Carey, a writer from Oregon, sent us a beautiful essay about the waiting years between when her dad was diagnosed with cancer and when he died. I'd like to read a few paragraphs from it. This is Waiting Room by Elizabeth Carey. One time between 1997 and 2001, my dad said, "If I had my way, I would know it was time to go and would push off on an ice floe like an old Eskimo without bother or burden." With little fanfare or hoopla, my dad wanted to go efficiently and quietly. We do not live near any ice floes, let alone an expansive ocean vast enough to allow for drifting away or floating over the horizon undisturbed. Planning for any trip these days is interrupted by appointments, pharmacy runs, phone calls, doctor emails, researching experimental studies, tattoo markers, chemo needles, and oh, pain. The pain of inactivity, the hurt of sitting. This pain melts glaciers, shrinks icebergs, stops snow, and brings out the bright, bright sun to shine on our vision of the land of the Eskimos. No running, no biking, no motorcycle riding, no driving, and then no walking. This light casts no shadows, just reveals a rock-hard landscape. Out here, the enemy is predatory and elusive, if definable. It is not the cougar that stalked Dad on his last antelope hunt, the one who left paw prints in the snow larger than Dad's outstretched hand. But it is after meat and bones. It waits, stalks, surges forth, slinks back, attacks, and then sits on its haunches, hunting the hunter with no map or compass or track. Its pervasive presence shapeshifts everywhere. I see it in family, in friends' families, at clinics, in the infusion room, on the street, in those hairless or jaundiced or toothless or scarred or perfectly normal except for hollowed-out eyes. I see its shifty iterations in every body tagged with a Livestrong band. We, with those plastic yellow wristbands, are on alert, watching for the formidable enemy. We count the days we are active one at a time. My father, an atheist, penciled future activities in his slim black monthly planner religiously, but the day he knew would come did so on its own time. Thank God for the straight-shooting hospice nurse. With her black bob motionless atop her petite plump frame, She put it to me. The force of her words pushed me back against the fridge, and I slumped to the floor. She put it to us, my mom and me, to be the ones to care for him, to help him go, to let him be, to push his ice flow into a cold, dark sea, to leave this wretched world and beautiful compassion and all the flighty antelope and sneaky cougars behind. Activity flurried and waned. We'd practiced for years. We knew how to hurry up and wait. Again, we hurried and waited. This time was for real, for love, for family. We watched our loss unfurl.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we explore what's new in kidney transplants and a new program to bring diversity to the health professions. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.